on this edition of Audio Berkman.
Government use of private information to go after people on grounds that have nothing to do with national security, then that would be very bad in a free society.
University of Chicago Law School professor Cass Sunstein on NSA surveillance and wiretapping. For Audio Berkman, I'm Colin Rinesmith. In an intense and often heated debate, Professor Sunstein and Jonathan Zittrain discussed whether or not the U.S. Constitution gives the president inherent authority to wiretap American citizens. And if so, is this action in violation of the Fourth Amendment? On this edition of Audio Berkman, we'll listen to this debate recorded live on January 18, 2006, at the Harvard Law School. Brought to you by the Berkman Center for Internet and Society.
The reason I was interested in this is that the level of outrage over the president's wiretapping seemed to me to precede engagement with the legal issues. And if what the president's doing is lawful, then the space for outrage is less than if what he's doing is unlawful. So on one view, the moral issue and the legal issue here are coextensive. Maybe that's not quite right, but at least they overlap a great deal. So the basic idea is it's very good to be as technical as we can in getting a handle on what the legal issues are. The way I would distinguish them is as follows. The first provision, which the Department of Justice has rightly emphasized, is the authorization to use military force that followed the September 11th attacks. And the court in Hamdi understood the authorization to include the power to detain enemy combatants in the face of the Non-Detention Act, even though the authorization to use military force doesn't explicitly contain the power to detain people. It's an authorization to use military force. So the first issue is whether the authorization to use military force implicitly carries with it the authorization to engage in surveillance of communications between al-Qaeda and Americans. Offhand, the best answer to that is yes, the authorization to use military force does include the power to spy on al-Qaeda members who are communicating with each other or with Americans. Surveillance is a time-honored aspect of the use of military force. There's no question that if the president wants to spy on communications between Taliban and al-Qaeda in the course of military operations in Afghanistan, there's no problem with that. I don't think there's any serious question that if the president wants, just speaking in terms of the authorization to use military force, if the president wants to spy on a phone call from al-Qaeda to New York City, he's entitled to do that, that the authorization to use force includes that power of surveillance. So that's the first issue, and important not to overlook it. Maybe the second one, analytically, is whether the authorization to use military force is best understood conformably with FISA, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, which would mean, on one view, that the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, because of its specificity and post-authorization amendment, means that even if the president is authorized to engage in surveillance, he has to do it conformably to FISA. And that is a plausible view. Let me raise a couple of questions about that view. That is the view that he has to go through FISA. Question number one is, it's not clear what's more specific, the authorization to use military force or the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. The Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act is more specific in the sense that it's targeted to the very particular question of warrants. But the authorization to use military force is more specific in the sense that it's targeted to the particular problem of responding to the attacks of 9/11. So if we didn't have anything else, whether the president has to go through FISA insofar as he's engaging in the kind of surveillance that the authorization is best read to authorize is not a simple question. Notice that the argument I've made thus far on the basis of the authorization to use military force is very narrow. It does not authorize the president to engage in spying on people who have no connection with the September 11th attack. That is, if neither party is connected with the September 11th attack. So if the president is spying on Hamas, communications between Hamas and American citizens, that's not authorized. We're talking about al-Qaeda and organizations that are connected with the September 11th attack. But the first claim is FISA and the authorization taken together don't necessarily mean that the president has to go through FISA. That's not entirely clear. There's a reasonable argument both ways. The second objection to the claim that FISA trumps the authorization to use military force has to do with the inherent power of the president to engage in foreign surveillance. A lot of people have made fun of the Department of Justice for its ambitious claims about the president's inherent power, and some of those claims really are very ambitious and lacking much support in case law. But here the Department of Justice and the executive is on firmer ground. It's not such a unusual claim of authority. The Supreme Court has left undecided the question whether the president has the power to engage in foreign surveillance. Five lower courts at last count resolved the issue, and they all resolved it favorably to the president on the basis of a longstanding historical judgment, which is the president can do this as part of, I guess, some combination of his power as executive and his power as commander-in-chief. Okay. Now, the structure of the argument, I hope, is emerging, and it would go like this. We might be unclear how to interpret FISA and the authorization, how to make them conform to one another. But if the president has a plausible claim of inherent authority to do this, then we ought to understand the authorization to use military force so as not to force the president to go through FISA if going through FISA would arguably conflict with the president's inherent authority. So this is kind of an old-fashioned clear statement principle, which is if Congress hasn't clearly intruded on presidential authority that might exist, we ought to avoid the constitutional question and interpret the president's authority consistently with his plausible claim. So here the argument would be there is an authorization. It's unclear whether it trumps FISA or vice versa. We ought to interpret it so as to trump FISA, so as not to raise a hard constitutional question. That is whether the Congress could intrude on the executive power. Okay. Now, where is that argument vulnerable? In two different ways, it's not airtight. One is it may just be that the notion that FISA, if it requires the president to go through the warrant process, doesn't intrude on any inherent power that there may be. So those who are skeptical about the five lower court decisions or who believe that even if the president does have this inherent authority, FISA's minimal burdens on the president don't violate it. If you believe either of those things, the president doesn't have the inherent authority, as some civil libertarians believe, or as other more technical types believe, FISA, if it does intrude on the president's inherent authority, doesn't compromise it in any real way, then the argument I've just made is vulnerable. There's no reason to invoke the clear statement principle if what I've just said is right. So that's one problem with it. The other problem with it is if you think there's a Fourth Amendment problem with the president engaging in warrantless searches of American citizens, even if they involve conversations coming from people who are reasonably believed, let's say, to be al-Qaeda, then there's a constitutional problem on the other side. So we might say if we have a conflict between FISA and the authorization, we should understand FISA to trump the authorization so as not to run into a Fourth Amendment problem. Whether there's a Fourth Amendment problem depends on a conclusion on the merits, which is whether the Fourth Amendment means that when the president is bugging American citizens who are communicating with antagonistic foreigners, there's a Fourth Amendment issue. And there are some suggestions from the lower courts that the ordinary warrant requirement doesn't apply, that it's a reasonableness inquiry, which would turn on what the president knows about the association between the foreigner and threats to the United States. And at least on plausible assumptions about the facts, the president knows some things which make this reasonable. Okay, to conclude, I think the legal issues here are intricate and difficult rather than simple and straightforward, as many people are saying. That is, many people think this is very simple stuff and the president's clearly violating the law. Vice President Gore appears to believe that. I think to the extent that he believes that, he's wrong. It's a hard question. If the president is bugging people in large numbers, that is, American citizens, without believing that, without having reason to believe that they're getting calls from Al-Qaeda or others involved in September 11th, then the argument I'm making is weakened because the authorization to use military force doesn't apply anymore, and all the president can rely on is his inherent authority, and that's a harder one for him. The ultimate conclusion is, I'm kind of agnostic on that. I tend to think, because of the extreme sensitivity of this issue to national security, federal judiciary ought to tread very cautiously. If the president is connecting his wiretapping to people involved in the September 11th attack, at least. Putting the legal issues to one side, there's a kind of inversion, I think, of the issue we're now debating and the historical context that gave rise to the legal and political culture within which the debate is occurring. If that's obscure, the legal and political culture within which the debate is occurring is Nixon's extensive wiretapping of political enemies in the midst of a war in which the security of Americans on American soil was not realistically jeopardized. We're in a context now which is fundamentally different, aren't we, in which, for all we know right now, maybe this will change, but there's no evidence that it will. President Bush is not targeting his political enemies in the least. There's no effort to wiretap dissenters or critics of the president. So the notion that he's trying to entrench his own political view, that's not been alleged by his fiercest opponents. And the threat to the United States isn't the kind of domino theory that underlay the Vietnam War, but it's instead much more immediate and real. And at least it's possible to think that this kind of double inversion, where it's genuinely trying to get at people who aim to do us harm, and in which the claim that the wiretapping is politically motivated hasn't been ventured, makes the assessment on the merits much more difficult. If the wiretapping is resulting in government use of private information to go after people on grounds that have nothing to do with national security, then that would be very bad in a free society. But if it's a kind of omnibus search based on some reason to think that the communications involve people who do us harm and the information isn't going to be used by anybody unless there is reason to believe that national security is at risk, it's at least a very different situation from the situations that caused the culture, which is so sensitive to wiretapping. What's to be done with that difference is unclear, but I bet when you hear other law professors and certainly members of the media very alarmed about this, the culture of the Nixon era is helping to drive their judgments. And whether it should it's not clear, is it? Might be the context means that's a misleading historical analogy.
So, Professor Zittrain, I'm wondering if you could respond to a couple things. One is how strong you think the Fourth Amendment question is, if you have an interest in that. Also, whether if you could speak to the broad, extremely broad nature of the searches, the sort of dragnet aspect of them, and the key difference also, another key difference from the Nixon era is, of course, the technological component, the ability to search is much greater. I wonder if you have thoughts on that.
Yeah, sure. I've been taking notes just as you've been talking. So far, kind of the agenda as we have it is up here. We haven't yet talked about what exactly is going on. I think there might be two components of that worth talking about, but I'm not yet going to talk about it. I first thought it might be useful just to walk through the discussion that you gave that just so nicely mapped out the kinds of arguments that are there. So we started with, is it legal? Presuming that what it is some form of domestic surveillance of at least one American citizen or other privileged person for these purposes that does not conform to FISA. And all hands, I think, seem to agree this does not conform to FISA. And what is FISA? It's a statute that provides for a secret court, secret in the sense of its proceedings are secret. We know who is on the court, and we know that it meets, and we know what its procedures and basic standards are. They tend to be less than probable cause as the standard by which the court would authorize a certain kind of eavesdropping. We also know, I think, as has come up a lot, that there are circumstances in which that court may retroactively validate or bless eavesdropping that had to take place in exigent circumstances. And everybody seems to agree that this does not conform to FISA, that absent some other justification, if you look at the statute, this would actually be contrary to the statute. And I had just pulled up the press briefing that the Attorney General and the now former director of the National Security Agency gave the Monday after the Friday in which this story broke. And here's the Attorney General saying that, yeah, there is a court order for this kind of surveillance unless it's somehow otherwise authorized. So our position is that it was otherwise authorized. But it's the pregnant negative of that is that, yes, FISA does not actually cover this activity. So, okay, we have the authorization for the use of military force. I was trying to pull up the text of this authorization, and I couldn't find it in a quick Google search. It's there, of course. It is, to my eye, a very vague statute. It's one of these kind of almost a declaration of war sorts of things that, you know, you go, President, go out and get the bad guys who did 9/11, and in particular, we authorize you to use force in Afghanistan to get these bad guys. Is that a pretty fair rendition? Yeah,
the words necessary and appropriate are there, and it's not just Afghanistan. It's all organizations, nations, and I think individuals who assisted or perpetrated the 9/11 attack, something like that.
Oh, look at that. The second link was actually you. And you saying that it says all necessary and appropriate. Right? So here it is. Look at that. Google offered up you as the source on what the thing actually says. Now, what I learned just now from what Professor Sunstein said was that it was such an interesting move. It had never occurred to me that to his eye, then, this is very specific because it's talking about a specific situation, right? The nations, organizations, or persons that planned, authorized, committed, or aided the terrorist attacks on September 11th, which makes it far more specifically controlling the circumstance that is under dispute than FISA itself. That's a really interesting argument, and I'm still kind of processing that because prior to hearing that, I would certainly have said that this is kind of a go-get-em president sort of thing, vague in that sense. And it's, in fact, its very vagueness that lets you say that the collection of signals intelligence is attendant to going to get them, and that FISA is highly specific. You can't fit FISA in a paragraph. It's a very lengthy set of statutory provisions that is meant to cover when you want to eavesdrop on agents of foreign powers that you believe may be having information attendant to the national security. So I would have said that it's not more specific, and that here, this is the first sort of argument, that we did have the Supreme Court say that the authorization for the use of military force allows the detention of people, including American citizens, if they're deemed enemy combatants. And if you can detain the people, how weird would it be if the AUMF didn't let you listen in on them? You've infringed their rights by listening in on them, but then when you seize them and take them to Guantanamo Bay or a Navy brig, that's not infringing their rights. That seems like an odd kind of move to make. And sure enough, as the Attorney General points out just a couple paragraphs later, was that there is a statute on point that's kind of the FISA of detentions. 18 U.S.C. 4001A says that the government can't detain an American citizen except by an act of Congress. And then they say, well, we've got that act of Congress. That's the AUMF. I'm not sure it's as direct as that because, for one thing, the fact that it's more dramatic to seize somebody off the street who likely has friends, you can't say for sure in theory, but somebody will know that the person is gone and may be making inquiry, whereas here, secret eavesdropping, you may not be in a position to know about and to object to, means that there isn't the kind of natural political counterbalance to seizing people off the street, precisely because it is more drastic than the counterbalance that is provided for widespread eavesdropping, even if one person on the other end has been linked to somebody connected to Al-Qaeda. And that link, from what we can tell from the press conference again, can be a very attenuated link. It can be who's everybody that was in the cell phone directory of this person now for all those people, who's everybody that was in their directory, and who's everybody that was in their directory. Before you know it, you've got Friendster, and you're friends with somebody who eventually knows somebody in Osama's family. And we would hope that the administration would, you know, rein it in a bit more than that, but it's hard to know because, again, most of the features of the program are secret. The other point I would want to raise maybe about the AUMF is that I don't know of any Supreme Court case that says that when Congress has spoken directly and clearly to something, as it has in FISA, that we could construe something vague like the AUMF to be a repeal or amendment to that. I understand that if Congress hasn't previously spoken at all, we might turn to something vague to find the authority in which to do it. I don't yet know that there's any authority to say that it can repeal. But on that point, am I just wrong?
No, it's a offhand, it's a good point. I think the strongest case the other way is Hamdi itself, where the court says this vague author is said over a disagreement from, as I recall, Ginsburg and Souter, said that the AUMF contain the authority, the specific authority, to detain in apparent contravention of the Non-Detention Act, which requires specific authority. And so Souter and Ginsburg said, look, this vague thing isn't the specific thing you need.
Yes.
But you're right, these are not identical issues.
And, of course, the other question is to what extent we should credit the legislative penumbras surrounding it as the resolution was negotiated and specific requests to allow for this kind of surveillance, I understand, were omitted.
Right.
And whether we should credit that at all or just read the text of the statute.
Right. I mean, two things. One is if there's a long historical acceptance of surveillance as part of war making, then the president's claim is strengthened, even in the face of the failure to add this specific stuff.
Yes.
And second, if the president does have a strong claim of inherent power to engage in surveillance, maybe particularly in the context of war, that would also be...
Yes.
Yeah.
So that turns us to the inherent power point that says, well, maybe the AUMF doesn't contain what we need to trump FISA, but FISA itself, under this argument, may be unconstitutional for the purpose of trying to constrain the president's power under Article 2 to wage war and to act as commander-in-chief. I think you already nicely discussed the avoidance question and the answer to the avoidance question, which might be you might avoid the Article 2 question only to find yourself now confronted with a Fourth Amendment question. And I gather, too, that in order to assert one's Article 2-derived powers, you basically have to assert them, right? You have to say, for executive privilege, I assert executive privilege and kind of dare the world to come back at you, which in these circumstances is much harder to do because the whole point of the thing is that it's secret.
Well, but the president has claimed he has inherent authority, as did President Clinton, that I have the inherent authority to do this.
Yes.
So I don't know that he has to do it publicly.
Uh-huh.
If he does it, if there's a constitutional challenge yesterday, and there was, I think he can say, I'm sure he can say, I have the inherent authority to do this.
Yes.
Yeah.
So then that raises the question, too, of, well, how does the Fourth Amendment fit in? And the fact that reasonable is present in the text of the Fourth Amendment to say, I don't know if we should call that up. If I say Fourth Amendment and you come up, I will be very impressed.
And let's I will see. Be very embarrassed.
Let's see. Here's Cornell's version of the Fourth Amendment. The right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures should not be violated. And then you have this warrant language. So it immediately gets to, you might see it as an invitation, say, to the Supreme Court to decide what is a reasonable or an unreasonable search. And anybody who's taken torts can say, you know, we could talk for 95 minutes on that subject and still maybe not get anywhere. To me, when I think about it, though, this actually connects then to the legal and political culture that Professor Sunstein was talking about, which is you could say that many searches are reasonable if they have probable cause, and yet we still have this practice at the criminal common law, or just criminal statutory law, of having warrants that issue, and you have to go satisfy a magistrate that probable cause exists, which is a different exercise than probable cause as an objective matter existing. And if the government were to say probable cause did exist, that's why we did the search, we don't need no stinking warrant because probable cause exists and we're prepared to litigate that when the time comes, that still, to me, might be dubious under the Fourth Amendment because under these circumstances, no, we have a desire for the executive to have to prove something to an independent set of people, even an independent set of people as friendly, institutionally speaking, as the FISA court, which, again, has been bandied about so frequently, over 17,000 yeses and five noes, that might be just these are very well-crafted requests going to the court, and it just shows how well the system is working. It may also show that when you have a non-adversarial process, it's real easy for the court to just say, that sounds good to me. Who am I to second guess? Yes, you are blessed. But the fact even of having to go to the court and under pain of perjury or other problems assert, I think, is a valuable feature of the system. And what we have here is a system that says, this is a program that if I had had my way, says the executive, you would never even have known about. So it's not even should we be outraged, it's should we know about it in order to decide whether to be outraged. And secondly, once we have that program going, do we have to be in touch with the other branches in a systematic way to get it vetted and to even get specific instances of surveillance approved? And the answer here appears to be not only no, but almost enduringly no, that the kind of war we're now in, I think I might acknowledge, is not a war that's going to have a quick end to it, and that therefore we'll just have this kind of surveillance going on indefinitely without the ability of a neutral party to have to be at least passing a laugh test when the surveillance is to be done. And that finally connects us to what exactly is going on here. And for what exactly is going on here, if they are individual bouts of surveillance that are exactly of the sort that FISA contemplated, and we have some reason to think there is some of that going on, it seems to me that we ought to ask that it fall under FISA at least once whatever exigency existed and that gives the president some maneuvering room has passed. And if in fact what's going on is not that, but this kind of data mining exercise where we would say that every internet exchange point is potentially being monitored and its contents being copied into a data bank because disk storage is cheap forever for the government to peruse at its pleasure, and ditto for every phone call passing through the standard telephony switches, you then have a data bank that, should things become Nixonian, the ability of the system to heal itself is compromised. That if Nixon had that tool up and running, it would have been much harder for Bernstein and Woodward not to be themselves blackmailed or cowed, or those who might listen to them to be cowed. And exactly what I think Judge Posner seemed to think was the opposite phenomenon today, that you can't keep a secret to save your life in this government, so don't worry, anything nasty will get out and be punished. I'm actually not so sure, given the extent of the power that we're handing the government, which to my eye is exactly the power the Fourth Amendment was meant to speak to and to have meaning about. And I don't have evidence that Bush is spying on his enemies, so I would assume, given the benefit of the doubt, he's not. We are in a political culture where if you are spotted with a bumper sticker that says no blood for oil before you go to a town meeting held for by the president and paid for by the populace, by the citizenry, that you have a golden ticket to it. You got it through some friend. It's legitimate that you're there, but you are actually removed from the room because they spotted the bumper sticker. I think it's really hard to be as pure as the driven snow and to trust then in one branch holding the keys to such powerful information.
How does that strike you?
Well, they're good points. I guess I'd say I'd want to distinguish between foreign surveillance and domestic surveillance. So if the nothing in what I've said would warrant, so to speak, domestic surveillance. I guess I'd also want to distinguish between foreign surveillance generally and foreign surveillance that involves some sort of reasonable basis to think it's one of our enemies who's calling.
I'm sorry to interrupt. When you say domestic surveillance, do you mean domestic
purely? Yes.
And foreign is one end foreign, one end domestic.
Yes. The president has not asserted the authority to monitor a phone call between Chicago and Cambridge.
But don't his arguments suggest that? If there were two Al-Qaeda operatives, just as you could arrest a guy when he lands in Chicago.
I don't think the inherent power, at least the inherent power, the particular inherent power argument we're discussing, which is the inherent power to engage in foreign surveillance, the AUMF, combined with the commander-in-chief power, does, in my view, authorize him to engage in surveillance of Al-Qaeda in Chicago calling someone in
California.
In California, but is that troublesome?
Well, that's domestic surveillance as a category,
right.
And
right.
Then we
that's
have
true.
To have on the scout's honor
that's
that
true.
We think it's.
That's
I didn't
true.
Mean to give the Vulcan piece. Of Maybe it's Mork and Mindy. Scout's honor that it's not
right
that these we have reason to think. And then again, what's the standard even for having reason to think? Do you think the Friendster model, which I think is what they're using. I didn't mean to make that a red herring.
Yeah.
Is that enough to say we should listen in?
Probably not. So that's the other point I wanted to make, which I agree. It's very important to know what is the standard of proof that's justifying the wiretapping. And if it's the case that there isn't reasonable basis or something, it's just a possibility, then the president's argument is much weaker. One thing it would be very good to know is something more about the facts, which have not come out enough. The president at one point said this is just Al-Qaeda. All this involves Al-Qaeda. If that's so, my arguments apply. If it's not so, some of Jonathan's arguments have more force, I'd say.
So here's a section of the press conference when General Hayden was asked, because this is exactly what they're saying, that it's Al-Qaeda that we're going after. And somebody says, well, who determined these targets were Al-Qaeda? Did you wiretap them? And I also imagine built into that is what level of proof did you have? And Hayden says it's made by the operational workforce at the NSA using the information they have. The standard that they apply, it's a two-person standard that must be signed off by a shift supervisor and carefully recorded, I don't know where the recording then goes, as to what created the operational imperative to cover any target, particularly with regards to those inside the United States. Follow-up question. So a shift supervisor is now making decisions that a FISA judge would normally make. I just want to make sure I understand. Is that what you're saying? And the answer from what I can glean from this is yes. But...
Well, that's not about the level of proof. That's about the reliability of the adjudicator, which is
yes.
a different point. Can I ask you, if it turned out, I know high-level officials in the government believe that this program has been effective in averting real attacks.
Yes.
If it turned out that there were three attacks on the order of the September 11th attack that were stopped
yes.
by this, would your judgment shift?
I think any time you put to me a dichotomy that says would you like the following civil liberty to be upheld, or would you prefer to see these 9,000 innocent people killed? I'm going to, or not upheld,
yes.
contravened. I would have to say, in that instance, I'd like to see it contravened. But that's why I almost fear that the argument proves too much, because in some ways it means we then rely more and more on what would otherwise be extra constitutional tools we don't find ourselves having to develop new ways.
My position is not that this program is wonderful and it's certainly lawful. It's that the legal issue is complicated, not simple, and whether it's on balance desirable depends on some things that we don't know enough about.
Agreed.
But if it's if you agree that so the form of the argument is that even if we stipulate that it's averted three very serious attacks. There's a slippery slope argument that doesn't make that a Trump. And whether that's convincing depends on whether we can meet the slippery slope argument. And my hope is that the argument with its structure allows the slippery slope argument to be met. For example, I leave open the possibility that if Congress specifically said the authorization to use military force does not include the authority to engage in foreign surveillance, that Congress would have that constitutional power and that the president's inherent authority would not be exclusive such that it would operate as a Trump. So if Congress wanted to do that, I'd leave open that possibility. Also, on my view, these wiretaps would be unlawful if the president doesn't have at least some reasonable basis to believe that the people are connected with al-Qaeda.
Yes.
So if it's a dragnet in one understanding of dragnet, then the arguments don't apply. Now, the policy question, whether dragnets are justified, also seems to me not that simple. I guess on the one side, we have the legal question, relatively simple, not allowed. The policy question, a little harder. Suppose it's the case that dragnets had some effectiveness in preventing attacks. And suppose it's the case that the dragnets were insulated from the Nixon fear. Then I guess I'm for the dragnets. But yes, so the fact that government – so I'm thinking that one of our policy differences, it's very interesting to me, and as I look at you, I think you're younger than I am. It should go the other way.
I should be hardened by the Nixon era.
Yes, and I should be have
excited about using computers.
I should be excited about exactly, and see September 11th in view. So what I don't quite get is the notion that the speculative fear of Nixonian use of this material is looms so salient on the policy calculus, whereas the I think somewhat less speculative judgment that there are people who are trying to kill Americans. And information technology, fortunately, can help stop them. Why that is, is trivia.
I wouldn't call it trivia. I would say that my indulgence of it, my embrace of it, is grounded in exigency. And that's why every time I see Jack Bauer make a split decision and those stupid bureaucrats that are trying to hold him down, I'm cheering for Jack. Because he's also always right, as it turns out.
Right.
But that at some point, we want to defeat that dichotomy of another September 11th versus this kind of infringement of civil liberties by saying, aren't there structural institutional remedies suggested by the very Constitution itself that could bring this kind of activity, including data mining, under a system of checks and balances without unduly affecting its efficacy? And have Congress do that.
A lot of that assumes the conclusion that this is an infringement of civil liberties and a violation of the Constitution, and that might be right.
Yes.
But I'm not sure that that's right. To develop a framework that would discipline the problem that you're concerned with, that's great, and maybe FISA is that.
I used to think FISA was off the rails. Now FISA seems so, safe and,
Well, right. Maybe, okay. What I think we have to understand, and we don't now, is why did the president not want to go through FISA? So this is many of those who object to this program say, why didn't he go through FISA? As if that's a rhetorical question, that he's bad, that he has no good reason. But it defies belief, doesn't it? To think there's no reason that's plausible that he didn't go through FISA. There has to be some national security reason that he didn't go through FISA. Otherwise, he would have gone through FISA unless he's
he, and I mean this, the Bush administration, is so bullheaded that it will gratuitously avoid FISA. And that would be a big surprise. It's in many respects bullheaded, but the idea that it's so bullheaded that it's gratuitously going to avoid FISA when it's used FISA a lot, that defies credulity. So let me give two reasons why I believe FISA was avoided. One is, even though the FISA court says yes, the application process is not simple. Think about applying to law school and now multiply that times something significant, and probably you've got an idea of a FISA application.
The Attorney General has to turn in references.
He has to turn in references from all sorts of people. And now think a little bit, not only that it's one person's law school application multiplied times X, where X is somewhere between 3 and 20, and then imagine you've got to have to do it 1,000, 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 times, and you think there are bad people here. And time is of the essence. So getting a yes is easy, but getting the application in is it's not the worst thing in the world. But if you want to do it thousands of times, it's difficult. I think that's one thing that's going on. And to the extent that that is, that suggests it's not a gratuitous bypassing of FISA. The other thing that I'm speculating here, but it's not completely drawn from imagination, is that for many of these people, the Bush administration does not have probable cause to wiretap. So the FISA court won't give them the wiretap. Though they don't have nothing. They have some sort of basis to believe that these people are against us. Now, suppose they can't say it's more likely than not, but it's far more than a scintilla of evidence, then as a policy matter, it seems to me, the president has a reasonable call. If he thinks, for example, 1 in 4 chance that this person is an enemy of ours, and here by enemy we don't mean trivial enemy, we mean interested in terrorist attack on the United States at some point in the next 5 or 6 years, and the president can wiretap a bunch of people like that when there may be 2,000 for whom the chance is 1 in 4 or more. Is it a terrible policy call? It might be unlawful, but is it a terrible policy call to say, I'm going to go after all of those 2,000 or 3,000 with respect to whom I think there's a 1 in 4 chance that they're against us? 400 of them, expected value are. Something like that. So the reasons for bypassing FISA, they can't have. It just is too easy to say, it's too pundit-like to say that they just stubbornly or needlessly didn't go through FISA. It must be there was some national security reason. I think these are the two, the time-consumingness of the applications and the absence of probable cause, though the presence of something. And if that's what's going on, moral outrage seems to me difficult to muster. Unless the misuse of this is intended or a realistic possibility.
Yes.
And the worst maybe that you could say is that some of the people being targeted, maybe we'll find this, are targeted partly on the basis of their names and their ethnicity, that that's a signal. So
yes.
It has a kind of racial profiling. But if what's happening is certain people with certain names and ethnicities are being listened in on a way that gives rise to no realistic threat of misuse at any point, is that so terrible? I don't know.
But what if you mentioned two reasons that seem to you to be sensible behind this non-acquiring of warrants? What is to assuage our fears that there are more sinister reasons behind not getting them, like the court would never grant this because we're just fishing, or we're targeting people, or whatever? You're saying there's been no indication that that's the case, but what indication would there be? It seems that this is a situation where we're expected to trust an opaque administration.
It's a good question.
You know,
just fishing is an interesting term. If what's meant by, and it's revealing, if what's meant by just fishing is many thousands of eavesdropping exercises where the expected probability for each is tiny. If it's that kind of fishing, then my second account, which is something short of probable cause but more than a scintilla of evidence, doesn't work. And if it's that kind of just fishing, then on policy grounds, it's reasonable to object, because unless we think that the likelihood of the fishing expedition is that something's going to turn up, and if there's assurance that what emerges from the fishing that doesn't involve national security threats will never be come out or be misused. But I agree with you that that's a legitimate objection. So in terms of the public airing of this, it's reasonable to be torn. If this program is one that has worked well at stopping terrorist attacks and its secrecy is indispensable to its good working, then we should be unhappy, shouldn't we, that it's come out publicly. If its success is mixed and the intrusions are real and the threats which you've described, nothing has been said that establishes they don't exist, then it's very valuable in a democracy to have an investigation. So I guess I distinguish between political wiretapping and misuse for political purposes, which is the worst. That's impeachable. And fishing expeditions, which are kind of desperate efforts that are crude at trying to find national security threats, that might be unlawful. But it's not.
Let me push the same button from a different point of view. Your assumption that this is done in good faith, let's credit it. Let us imagine that the President of the United States has said to the Director of the Spook Intelligence Service, I want you to use every means at your command to find and oust al-Qaeda. Every single means. The only limitations I want you to respect are those of practicality. Use every resource that you possibly can. Right. And now we look and see what the resources are that are at our disposal. And we see that we're now able to tap into a world communication system which doesn't distinguish boundaries one way or the other. Right. I, as the director of that intelligence operation, I'm going to make exactly the database that John's talking about. I am going to filter everything. Now I run my computers on the operation. And my God, if I had a 1 in 1,000 chance that I was looking at somebody, that's big time. That's a big fish already. I mean, we start with zero. And the slightest increase in probability after this thing, which is largely undefined, al-Qaeda, it's whatever, it would seem to swamp everything.
Okay, that's great. That's very helpful. First, if the president says to the CIA director or the intelligence agencies, use everything you practically can to stop terrorism, he needs to get his lawyers involved. And his lawyers have to say that that's not what you can do. You don't have inherent or statutory authority to do that. So whether when Professor Goldsmith was there, he's someone I very much do trust, confident he did not say, Mr. President, that this is acceptable. So there are legal constraints. And what I was trying to say is that on a certain understanding of this program, which may or may not turn out to be accurate, there's a respectable argument it's lawful. Okay. Second point, let's just go with your example. Let's suppose the intelligence agencies had the technologies, maybe we're not far from that, maybe we'll be there in a decade, where they can get every email and every phone call and by technology do some filtering. Some of you in the room probably understand how this might be done, that could find stuff that has a significant probability of being connected with terrorism, and then hone in on it, as you say. So it's universal transparency of the citizenry to the government via technology. Okay, I think the post-Nixon culture, and this was the tenor of your question, thinks that that's horrendous. That's really frightening. And that may turn out to be right, But it depends on some factual assumptions, doesn't it? And I think that there are two that have to drive the judgment that it's horrendous. One, or is this just wrong? It has to be assumed there will be some kind of misuse, doesn't it?
If there's no kind of misuse, is it terrible if people in the CIA are reading every word that comes out of your mouth or computer? Okay, let me say, I guess this is a controversial thing to say, that if the head of the CIA hears every word that comes out of my computer or mouth, and not all of them are unembarrassing, those words, what's the problem? Now, if some of those words are going to be used for malevolent purposes, then there's a problem. Okay, so I think that there's a kind of heuristic in the minds of the American citizenry, which is probably a good one, which quickly slides from availability to government of information to its misuse, as if they're the same thing. And maybe, practically speaking, it's just so. But there's no logical reason to think it's just so. And indeed, the existence of this program, which apparently has gotten a ton of information, none of it apparently misused, is evidence that there's a gap. Okay. Second thing is whether the scenario you describe is a nightmare story or instead a happy story. We could write science fiction stories both ways, couldn't we? Where it's a totalitarian scenario of fascist America, or we could describe it as the CIA protecting us in a way that leads never to misuse. Suppose it's the case that this universal transparency, didn't David Brin write an essay, a book of science fiction about this?
The Total Transparent Society.
With the helpful name, The Transparent Society. Okay, suppose we had full transparency and to the government, and part of the consequence of it is protection against terrorist attacks. Ample protection against terrorist attacks. So I guess I think that that this is not lawful, and the president has to follow the law. That's clear, as Judge Alito recently said. But if it were lawful, whether it's horrendous or okay depends on two empirical questions. One involves misuse, and the other involves incremental security. And I sense a lot of skepticism in the room, but I don't understand why. I think there's an implicit fighting of the assumptions which I'm trying to say are necessary to an evaluation. That is, I think there's fighting of the assumption it won't be misused, and there's skepticism about the assumption that it is necessary to protect national security. And if the fighting is successful, then I'm with you. But it's a fight.
I know a lot of people want to get in. I just want to quickly say David Brin's Transparent Society book is premised on the notion that we shouldn't care too much about invasions of our own privacy so long as it's an equal opportunity invasion and we get to watch the watchers. Fine, the police want to watch us, we get to watch the police, and then you get the Posner situation where the minute the police beat somebody, everybody sees it, and then the system is self-checking. I see half of Brin's Transparency Society in this program, but not
we don't know
the other half.
Yes, but whether or not knowing about it is good or bad also depends, doesn't it, on some of this stuff.
Yes.
Well, I would love to take you up on your first proposition about how the president and the lawyer relate, but I...
I want to say is I'm not saying that within the White House this has generally happened.
No, I'm not saying... If I'm putting myself in the Bush position and crediting your vision of what that position is, that I'm genuinely in good faith thinking that I'm waging a war and al-Qaeda is my enemy, and that I'm somehow making progress in the war by the way I'm doing it, I am going to tell the head of my secret intelligence operation, you do whatever the hell it takes to win this war. This is a long history of atrocity in war. Yeah. Wiretapping is way low down on the totem pole. You do it. And what I say to my lawyer is, if you've got a problem with this, you're old-fashioned. Your job is to make this work as far as the American public and the American legal system is concerned. It's not to tell me I can't do it.
Well, that kind of president is a lawless president.
Except that on your assumption, I credit his good faith, and you credit...
Well, he's a good faith law.
...authority as the president... yeah. is to win the war.
But I don't believe the president has the inherent authority to try to win the war. He may have inherent authority to engage in foreign surveillance. He doesn't have inherent authority, on my view, to torture people. That is not a plausible reading of commander-in-chief power. But because of history, the foreign surveillance, five lower courts said, is part of the inherent authority. So.
A lot of your argument, you have a lot more trust than I do. Colin, are we going to get these folks in if we don't have them with microphones, or should we actually use some of these microphones, or will that work for you?
That'll be okay. I can raise the volume here. So.
And a lot of it rides on there not being misuse. But I'm curious, in your view, who defines misuse, and how do you know how they're defining misuse? Because the way this is set up right now, it seems like there isn't a way to find that out. Like, they hold a press conference, and they have a sort of vague answer, and then that's that, and we trust.
Yeah, I don't know if I have more trust than you do in the authorities. All I meant to do was to say that the level of trust is crucial to an evaluation, and that whether there should be trust or not is an empirical question. Okay, and I guess I'm comforted by the fact that there's no evidence so far that the wiretapping exercise has resulted in going after political enemies or anything even vaguely of that kind. Now, the absence of evidence isn't itself evidence, so... Yeah. Well, it would be surprising, wouldn't it? If there's at least if there's widespread,
there'd be whistleblowing.
Mm. There'd be lawyers involved. The fact that detention of there were abuses and they came out of other sorts of programs. So I guess all I want to say is that there's an empirical question that various assumptions about trust or distrust can be established by reference to. Now, you add rightly that there's also a conceptual question, which is what counts as misuse. And I haven't thought that through, so it's a very good question. I guess I was thinking that the most obvious example of misuse would be political punishment. In the sense that eavesdropping is used against the president's political adversaries. But there are other kinds of misuse, aren't there? Or at least of arguable misuse, one of which might be, suppose the president picks up that someone is not a national security threat at all, but they are gambling unlawfully or engaged in some sort of mob-related enterprise and goes after that. Now, I guess I can't find myself getting all upset about that, but some people might, that if this is a eavesdropping program for national security purposes, it counts as misuse if the president starts using it to go after other forms of illegality. So, but I'd be interested, this would be very interesting to figure out. And, of course, as the universe of what counts as misuse expands, if we have a broad conception of the concept, then distrust becomes more plausible because we can distrust more things.
Yeah, I agree that at least in part the issue of whether there's been misuse is an empirical question about whether there's been a misuse, but I sort of thought that question had been answered pretty convincingly in the last couple of years. I mean, Bolton, during his hearings, admitted that the NSA was giving information that it had gathered to policymakers, the FBI, to other intelligence agencies. Newsweek, I guess, conducted a report that did an investigation, and they found that during an 18-month period between 2004 and 2005, the NSA supplied maybe 10,000 United States citizens to bureaucrats and spies and the rest of it. And the FISA court itself got very upset at the NSA for doing this sort of stuff, for sharing information with the FBI and allowing prosecutors to use NSA searches to sort of to conduct them and to initiate those searches for their own gains and the rest of it. So, I mean, I agree this is an important question, but it seems like there's a history of abuse for the NSA, and they've got a reason on that.
Yeah. I wrote a paper with a colleague about capital punishment in which the paper engages the possibility that capital punishment is morally fine if it deters and saves innocent lives.
And capital punishment is very bothersome to me. And I asked my co-author, don't you find our paper a little troublesome to write, even though, of course, we agree with our paper, because capital punishment is a gruesome thing. He said he just doesn't have a gene for being grossed out by capital punishment. So there's something in his brain that doesn't get fired when he thinks about capital punishment. And I'm wondering whether I just lack that with respect to the examples that you give, because I sense that the room resonated when you said that the NSA wiretaps, the information is being shared with, e.g., the FBI. By itself, to me, that's not horrible. It's being shared with the FBI. Is it being turned into anything? If it's being information sharing within the government, that's good. That's what we want. So the fact that it's being shared with the FBI is, on this view, not itself troublesome in the least. If the FBI is then you said, something more bothersome to someone whose brain doesn't go off at this sort of thing, it's just a lack, I guess, and that is that it's being used by prosecutors. But maybe these are bad actors who committed bad offenses.
If it were being used selectively by prosecutors to go after little offenses, because all of us mess up on our taxes, even if it's not intentional,
yes,
that's a form
yes,
of political
that's right.
harassment.
That, well, not necessarily political, but objectionable. So if what happens is they hear someone saying, I didn't report this income I got from that, and then the government goes, even that, among the bad things that happen in life, it's not that horrible. The NSA finds out about tax fraud by some little person, and then the person gets in some trouble as a result. Is that so terrible? People should pay their taxes.
So as a policy matter, why not get rid of the warrant requirement?
Well, because of the risk – well, for one thing, the notion that the warrant requirement – I don't think it's a universal truth, as Jane Austen novels start, that warrant requirements are necessary in free societies.
Right.
So whether the warrant – so there's no acontextual argument for the warrant requirement.
Right.
Not having thought about this much, I tend to think the warrant requirement is good because the intrusion on legitimate law enforcement interests isn't that big, and the protection it gives to innocents against harassment and – worse is significant. So to have someone go into your house is an irritating and invasive thing,
right,
even if nothing turns up. To have the CIA have your emails, it seems to me, is a very bothersome thing if it's going to be misused.
It's interesting. It's almost like that Stephen Wright joke of the person who snuck into my house and replaced everything I owned with an exact duplicate. That I at least would rather have the police come when I'm there and be humiliated than to have it be the case that they came yesterday when I wasn't there and that I was none the wiser. That second search to me is more...
I'm having a hard time getting my mind around it.
A secret search versus a non-secret search.
But you are the wiser in the sense that then you learn that it happened.
Yes.
I was wondering if it was metaphysical, but you don't mean it that way. Okay, so the idea is that a secret search?
That the humiliation aspect of a search is not the only intrusion, even if nothing is found.
Well, I guess I do think that if the government has technologies, and this is like the question asked, whether the secret
right.
search is what we're actually observing. But I think what bothers you about that, I really do think what bothers you about that is an empirical hunch, which is that the stuff is going to be misused, if not now, tomorrow.
And that it structurally could be, yes.
And that is in your analysis, isn't it? That in some future Nixonian, and I sense that's in the skeptic's view, and that's fine. So I have nothing to say against that.
And I guess the framers.
The question is whether it's true.
The framers had their own Nixon, I guess. They had a king that they.
Yes, but we don't want to be formalists, do we? And I don't think. And say, kind of,
it was good enough for the framers; it must be good enough for us.
Yes, just because what what the Constitution calls for in this circumstance is contested. If it were plain that the president is violating the Fourth Amendment, then I'd be completely with you. My understanding is that whether the president's violating the Fourth Amendment in these searches is uncertain.
So where is the check and balance in the situation where, as you say, if they're abusing it, that would be a problem, but they say whether we're abusing it or not is completely buried in the deepest of classified information, and you and no one else is ever going to find out?
Well, that's a good question. Yeah. As I understand it, there are some members of the Senate, the majority and minority heads of the relevant committees, who knew this. So there's something there. And they didn't object. So there's a little
check. Except they wrote a handwritten letter that they put in their own vault saying that they couldn't sleep well that night after they heard it.
Right.
Which is different from objecting.
Yes. Yeah. So there's some check there. And it's a good, I mean, if we think that the risk of misuse is real, then the absence of a check is a problem. Whether it's decisive depends, doesn't it, on the magnitude of the risk and the magnitude of the gains, to talk University of Chicago talk. So you might, there's some things, aren't there, for which the absence of a check is actually a good thing, because the check wouldn't be worthwhile, all things considered. Okay, I'll give you one that maybe will appeal to you. Grading monitors. Your grades aren't monitored by some super grader, Jonathan, who makes sure your grades are accurate. Now, why is that? It's not because there's special need for secrecy with respect to grading. It's just because that check wouldn't be, it would be do more harm than good. We're stipulating. So the absence of a check, it's a problem, especially because I share the sense that the risk of misuse is a source of concern. But it's not a knockdown argument.
So let me turn around the other side.
Yeah.
My understanding of Brin's book, his premise is that this society that he's talking about is in some sense inevitable. And in our conversation here, you say, well, maybe the technology in 10 years will make it there. Maybe it's much closer than that.
Right.
But if that's the case, then in a sense it becomes inevitable. That is, if the United States is not doing it, somebody else is going to be doing it, and the United States is going to feel disadvantaged.
No, that's good.
So come around then to the positive part of the problem. This is going to be happening, and there is a potential for abuse. Maybe it's not actual yet, but there is a potential. How would you approach the impending problem of potential abuse with this inevitable massive database of everything?
Okay, here's a suggestion. That's great. That Congress should revisit FISA, that it's technologically outmoded, and anyway, it's basically pre-9/11 stuff. And so if the president is right as I think the White House believed, that the application process is time-consuming, even though the getting a yes is easy, and that the probable cause standard is too demanding, then it's easy to do something with FISA to overcome that. So here's the idea. We need a structural response to the technological change, to the risk of abuse, and to the national security needs. And the Berkman Center, maybe, together with the evidence class, should be focusing on what that would look like. Actually, your question spurs more ambition in thinking about this than Congress has shown thus far. Congress has wanted to investigate, hasn't it, the legality and the morality of this activity, which I think is probably good. But no one, to my knowledge, has said FISA really needs to be rethought. And if on rethinking something like the structure is right, then it should be made crystal clear that authorizations to use military force don't displace it. And then we can have a constitutional challenge by the president if he wants to make it. Not clear it can be litigated, but it'll be like the War Powers Resolution. And then we'll have that. But your question really suggests that's what needs to be done. So I think in our world, the concerns about misuse of information are sufficiently weighty that just to say trust the president is not right. So So a new FISA.
There's a guy in the back who's been waiting to get in.
I'm French, and I understand that you are not addressing like the international issue here.
Yeah.
But I have like a bad faith question, which is related to your question actually. I don't know on what side it can be used, because basically it's about the efficiency of just national regulation, because the stronger the surveillance of American citizens will be enacted in the U.S., the more incentive the U.S. government will have to ask other agencies, foreign agencies, to give their data to them. And actually, there is nothing like international conventions about that today, and they are already exchanging data about their own citizens. So if it's strongly like protected in the U.S., how is it possible to manage to make it to enforce it in this like global exchanging system?
Can you say this is a great point? But can you tell me what you're worried about? Are you worried that the U.S. might have strong protections against disclosure or misuse, but what the French government hears? Sees what the United States knows, discovers that Jonathan reads Fantastic Four comics every month, and then publicizes that? Is that a secret?
Not anymore.
That's exactly, but the fact is that thinking about it only at a national level, in the world we're living today, is maybe like illusionary.
Yes, I've got it. But what are you worried about? The fact that the information will be shared, and that some nations might not have safeguards against misuse that others do. See, offhand, I don't see the worry yet, because if France learns, for example, that not only does Jonathan read Fantastic Four comics, but that he liked Howard Dean for a moment, a lot, even after the scream. Then what's the risk? If France learns embarrassing personal or the real risk, it seems to me, is that America will learn things about American citizens that can be misused. But if France or Saudi Arabia does, is that fear?
That's what I mean, because the problem, for example, I don't think the problem is that is the American agencies ask data to the French agencies about American citizens, because of course we have like a common global protection level.
Right.
What if instead of asking to French agencies, they begin asking like to other agencies that don't share the same level of protection that we do in our countries, in democratic countries. And when that happens, what will you? I mean, you can trust President of the United States of America.
Maybe.
Can you trust the people you will address to in order to get information?
Okay, well, on whether we can trust the President of the United States, I've said that is an largely empirical question, though partly conceptual, that has to be addressed to make evaluation. So I don't mean to say there's no risk of misuse. It's very important what you're saying. I see that, as I hadn't before you said it. But what I don't see is what the concrete fear is. Suppose the United States gets information, what, about citizens of France, that they like Spider-Man comics or that they're gambling on the Internet. Since the United States has no jurisdiction to hurt the citizens of France, except when they come into the U.S., and the U.S. has better things to do, doesn't it, than to harass French citizens who read Spider-Man and gamble. So the real threat seems to me domestically. So if the information is shared, the notion that one country will plot against non-miscreants of another country because of their political beliefs or embarrassing personal facts, of the various things we have to worry about, isn't that low on the list?
As I understood the question, maybe in reference to the Echelon project, which is some people claim an end run around domestic spying by farming it out to the UK or Australia or allies who then report if they find anything. And I fear that maybe that
Okay, that's where the U.S. will use information that's acquired by Canada, say, about American citizens, and it'll use it against American citizens not because they're terrorists or gamblers, but because they're Dean supporters. I mean, this would be a real problem, yes.
I think that we've reached the end of the hour for the large group. I'd like to thank Professor Sunstein for coming and answering all of these questions for us and engaging this conversation and presenting a different study of you. Please stay after if he's willing to be detained further.
Thanks for arranging this. Did you always hear this at the end of class?
Well, it's the Howard Dean screen.
Oh, is it? Did you put it on?
Yeah.
No, that's great.
You've been listening to Audio Berkman, brought to you by the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard Law School.